address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber-stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear, and it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. Nowtown is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Quiche Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Quiche is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Quiche is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Quiche, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Quiche, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Quiche lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Quiche to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Quiche is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Quiche officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Quiche has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalalip from Quiche Island.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's prime minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment.
Delegates from our coalition met with President Mattarella, and they agreed over the fact that there are many emergencies at national and international level, and quick answers are needed.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new foreign minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kyiv. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine.
We must do all we can to stop the war through negotiations and dialogue, and the new government must help Italians to pay energy bills. We are on our knees.
We are confident that the new government will do good. Its biggest challenge will be easing the impact of soaring energy bills on Italians.
Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me on camera. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes. This woman, sobbing into her hands, tells me she has family in Ukrainian territory. They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses. Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly. While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years. While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep. And very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purisa, London.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Democracy is under threat in the U.S. Even the midterm elections could leave democracy weaker ahead of the 2024 presidential race. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, The Guardian reported this week on the efforts of tech billionaire Peter Thiel to influence U.S. politics. It's an important piece about more than just this election cycle. Thiel's power shows that Citizens United has done to U.S. democracy. With 3 weeks to go until Election Day, outside groups have already spent some $1.3 billion to influence the outcome of the midterms. Thiel's nearly $30 million in donations account for only a fraction of that nearly unbelievable total, but he represents a very specific kind of influencer. As Kristen Lee told The Guardian, since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. Billionaires are sponsoring candidates like prized racehorses. The situation is worrying, exceedingly worrying, but not unprecedented. During the Gilded Age, moneyed corporate interest held incredible sway over the U.S. government. Senators who represented the copper-rich state of Montana, for example, were referred to as representing copper rather than representing their constituents or the state itself. Copper magnate William A. Clark bought himself a seat in the Senate by plying the state's legislators, who at the time elected U.S. senators with massive financial gifts. Once Clark's corrupt practices were revealed, his 1889 opponent, also revealingly a copper magnate, worked to have him removed from Congress. Clark came back in 1901, defeating, you guessed it, another wealthy mine owner to win a Senate seat. The citizens of Montana finally took their government back in 1912, enacting a law that barred corporations from intervening financially in elections. That law stood for a century, until the Supreme Court struck it down and, inconsistent with Citizens United, decided in 2010. Shortly after the Citizens United ruling, President Obama asked Americans to imagine the power this will give a special interest over politicians. We don't have to imagine anymore, we are living it. Till is a particularly alarming example. Through massive donations to super PACs, which Citizens United brought to the fore, he's using his riches to force his fringe views into mainstream political discourse. He's supporting candidates who spread the false claim that fraud decided the 2020 election. And his money doesn't just force a certain type of candidate into the public eye. It also silences Till's ideological opponents. By working to defeat the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, for example, Till has deterred others from speaking out against the former president. Few politicians can afford to ignore Till and the threat his money holds. We don't have to continue down this road. Many groups, including Brennan Center, have proposed legislation to limit billionaires' influence over elections without running afoul of Citizens United. We don't need a billionaire's approval like the people of Montana did in 1912. Americans can exercise the power they have as citizens and take back the U.S. government. Also, Guardian wrote, Peter Thiel is far from the first billionaire who has wielded his fortune to try to influence the course of American politics. But in an election year when democracy itself is set to be on the ballot, he stands out for assailing a long-standing governing system that he has described as deranged and in urgent need of course correction. The German-born investor and tech entrepreneur, a Silicon Valley disruptor who helped found PayPal alongside Elon Musk and made his fortune as one of the earliest investors in Facebook, has catapulted himself into the top ranks of mega donor class by pouring close to $30 million this year's midterm elections. He's not merely favoring one party over another by supporting candidates who deny the legitimacy of Joe Biden's election as president and have, in their different ways, called for the pillars of the American establishment to be toppled entirely. Till's priorities this midterm cycle have partly aligned with those of Donald Trump, with whom he has had an on-again, off-again relationship since writing him a $1.25 million check during the 2016 presidential campaign. Till, like Trump, has made it his business to end the careers of what he calls the traitorous 10 Republican House members who voted to impeach Trump in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. Four of these members opted not to run for re-election at all, and four more, including Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the House committee investigating January 6th, went down in the primaries. But there are also signs that Thiel is thinking around and beyond the former president. The lion's share of his largesse, $28 million and counting, has been directed towards two business protege who, with his help, have established themselves as Gatley right-wing darlings. J.D. Vance, the best-selling author of the blue-collar memoir Hillbilly Elegy, who is running for Senate in Ohio, and Blake Masters, a self-styled anti-progressive and anti-globalist who is running for Senate in Arizona. Over the past decade, ever since the Supreme Court dramatically loosened the rules of political campaign, giving in its Citizens United decision, Thiel has placed sizable fortunes on candidates who are not only conservative but have sought to challenge long-standing institutional traditions and break the Republican Party's own norms. Senator Ted Cruz in Texas and Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri, as well as Trump himself. Masters, who has campaigned on the notion that psychopaths are running the country right now and is spoken approvingly of the anti-establishment philosophy of 1990s, Ona Bomber, and Vance, a frequent speaker on the university circuit during his book tour days, who now says universities are the enemy, fit the same mold. They and Thiel all have ties to a branch of the new right known as NatCon, whose adherents believe broadly that the establishment needs to be torn down, much as Thiel and his fellow Silicon Valley disruptors believed 2 decades ago that the future lay in destroying long-standing business models and practices. Thiel himself opined as far back as 2009 that he no longer believed democracy to be compatible with freedom and expressed little hope that voting will make things better. While a member of Trump's presidential transition team in 2016, he flashed his institution-busting instincts by proposing that a leading climate change skeptic, William Happer, be appointed as White House science advisor. He also pushed for a libertarian Bitcoin entrepreneur who did not believe in drug trials to head up the Food and Drug Administration. Such proposals were too much even by Trump's iconoclastic standards. Steve Bannon, Trump's ultra-right campaign manager and political strategist, told a Thiel biographer, "Peter's idea of disrupting government is out there." Thiel did not respond to a request for an interview, and these representatives did not respond to multiple invitations to comment. Masters and Vance also did not respond to inquiries.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has another new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has said that he was not daunted by the scale of the economic challenge, pledging to lead the country through an economic crisis and to rebuild trust in politics. Well, that makes one wonder whether Sunak is really aware of the scale of the economic crisis that the UK is in, from inflation to the cost of living crisis to the political infighting and radical changes in policy that have horrified investors, alarming international allies. Sunak has his hands full. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Sunak has the solutions needed to bring the UK out of this economic and political mess.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the, as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as he. Most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of, close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, we're going to go with our guests. Let me introduce them for this program. Limpet Opec, former member of the British Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Shebri Rizvi, political analyst, who also joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Limpet Opec, taking a look at the soap opera there in the UK with Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old former hedge fund boss. I picked these out, see what you think. Only been in politics for 7 years, and estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. And that is pointing to what many are feeling, that he may not be able to connect with Brits who are feeling inflation or who are in poverty. Obviously, a public that's strained by things that are that have put them into the crisis that they're in right now. Is that accurate?
We shall find out. But you've accurately raised his potential Achilles heel. Let's be honest, for a man who is worth over £700 million, a small increase to him of a couple of £1,000 in energy bills isn't going to be very important. He could almost be regarded as a hobby politician because he isn't going to suffer if the economy does. And so that's the biggest single question. Can he understand what millions of people in the UK are now suffering in terms of finances. The second one is, can he fix it? Liz Truss, in her 44 days in office, managed to trash the British economy. It was already in trouble, partly because of some idiotic energy policies, but she wrecked it. My estimate is that she has cost mortgage payers in the United Kingdom £80,000 million a year in extra interest rates. I'm one of those people. So can Rishi Sunak really wind back to the clock to a time where we had much more favourable interest rates, and for a lot of people, paying an extra £8,000 or £10,000 a year is going to make them essentially poor? And then the third and the last point, is he clubbable? By that I mean, can he do what Boris Johnson did very well, which was appeal to individuals who wouldn't normally vote Conservative, but they did this time, and they gave Boris Johnson a big majority. Now, those are three big challenges. Of course, I'm not saying Labour Party could do any better, but they could win by default. If he doesn't do three out of three of the things I listed there, then two out of three isn't good enough, and that means he could lose the general election. That's what he's going to be judged on by his own party.
Taking a look at his economic agenda there, Shabir Rizvi, what is it? Do you know? Do we know? I mean, at this point, it may be too early to tell.
Hello, good evening. I don't think it's too late, because obviously the Sunak scenario is exactly the same as what the Conservative Party has been practicing for the last 12 years. We are told that it's going to be a difficult time. We have to take bold decisions, at the same time, he needs to fix the economy. What are these bold decisions? Does that mean that further cutting of the healthcare, further cutting of the schools sort of funding, further cutting on other social services in the United Kingdom? So if that's what he means by bold decisions, what I would say the bold decisions would be is to, cap the bonuses of the bankers in London. It would be to increase perhaps the taxation to the highest earners, the 1%. His own cabal, who is in the category of millionaires, should they be paying more? Perhaps a bold decision would be to have a windfall tax on the energy providers. A bold decision on the economy would be to, bring parity for the lower paid earners, i.e., for example, just take one instance, a nurse at the beginning, 12 years ago, when the Conservative Party came into power, is £4,000 less well off than she was 12 years ago. So bold decision would be to bring equal parity to the key workers, nurses, the policemen, the teachers, the care workers. I can go on. Multiple other sort of employees who have really lost out, not just on pay increases not taking place, but due to the inflation, they're actually a lot poorer than they were even 12 exactly. years ago. So bold decisions. So as I said, the Sunak scenario doesn't sound any different than what has been practiced for the last 12 years. Yes, of course, the previous prime minister we've had, as you know, three prime ministers in 3 months, and hers was really an experiment to see whether ideological, okay. fundamentalist, right-wing economic policies should be applied to the United Kingdom. And we saw what happened. Mr. Sunak being more clever than Truss would actually do it more gently, but the end result would be more austerity, poor becoming poorer, and really the belt tightening would be required of the 99%, whilst the 1% really go to the bank all the way laughing.
When you have 17% of an increase in things like food, for example, lump at OPEC, and of course we can talk about the inflation into other sectors, in particular at the top of the list practically would be the energy sector and gas bills. He's got to do something about those two. But the fact that our guest, Shabir Rizvi, talks about income, how it's fallen behind, obviously was behind. Inflation obviously put that in fifth gear in terms of it falling behind even more. There's got to be an impact soon. But that could only be done if you're generating income. Not to get too technical about this, but generating income would then come in through the form of projections in one sense. But in this atmosphere of a war and lack of energy and what we're looking at, which is a recession, which many say the UK is not in one, but it is in a recession, how can he bring in results quickly, which is the key here?
We are in a recession in any meaningful way. The average citizen, not the millionaires, but the average citizen is feeling a lot poorer. And you've mentioned the three big things here: mortgages, fuel costs, and food costs. Those three are crippling anyone who was just about managing a few months ago. And turning to your question and continuing the debate, it's very hard to see what Rishi Sunak can do quickly without either borrowing even more, and he has borrowed more than any chancellor in the history of Britain, certainly since World War II, or making the kind of cuts that my colleague has just listed. Both of those are very difficult. It's probably easier for him to borrow, but then, of course, the world has just marked down the credibility of British politics and British government because it borrowed so much. At least it was going to under Liz Truss. So what is he to do? He can hope for a miracle. It's not going to come. He can ditch the energy policies, which are based heavily on environmental policies now. Wherever you stand on whether there's a climate crisis or not, Britain can't afford to do this right now. He should ditch net zero, and he should use fracking and domestic oil production to quickly reduce fuel prices. In terms of food prices, they'll then come down a little bit, just because energy is so important. Fuel is such a high percentage of most of the costs in the United Kingdom. But the big one is actually the mortgage situation. If you have a £200,000 mortgage, you're paying £8,000 a year extra every year. That dwarfs the increase in energy costs. What can he do about that? The only thing he can do is get interest rates down. Two ways to do that. One is to convince the Bank of England it can do that. And that's difficult when you've got 10% inflation. Or he could renationalize the Bank of England. That's the radical thing he could do. He could own interest rates, as occurred for decades, for pretty much a century in the UK, before a gesture of virtue signaling, the Labour Party said, no, you go off and set the interest rates independently. But as you can see from that list, it's a really difficult thing for Rishi Sunak to deliver. And probably it's going to get worse rather than get better. He's going to have a winter of discontent.
We need to understand, Shabir Rizvi, if you can, with the short amount of time that we have, as to and why, I should say, the UK is in the position that it is in terms of its economy, which is cited to be one of the worst of the G7 countries, not just because of the pandemic, but prior to that. And maybe even some saying as far back as the 2007-08 financial crisis when it hit, maybe the UK was not able to truly recover. And it was just dragging itself along with GDP increases that were not that noteworthy. Are we looking at that far back when it comes to the UK economy dragging its feet and not doing well? And then, of course, then you got COVID and then you got the Ukraine conflict and here we are.
Well, indeed, one has to look back over the last 12 years. And I have quite often pointed this out in our conversations on this matter, is that the financial crisis that hit the world in 2008, and of course it hit USA, the European Union, then we had what is called quantitative easing, literally government buying their own security, printing of money, all kinds of things. But then we had a Conservative Party came into power soon after in 2010. And they practiced really an ideologically based economic policy of austerity. This is usually what the IMF sort of prescribes to developing world, wherever there's economic issues. They say that, you know, have austerity, sort of increase this, do less sort of social welfare issues that impact the majority of the public. That kind of formula was applied not at the behest of the IMF, but really the government, which was ideologically based and wanting to really continue the practice of very sort of monetarist approach to the British economy. And here we have 12 years later, yes, you know, the mantra in the UK is even when the former Prime Minister Truss was leaving, she said, Putin. But really, look, you know, the war in Ukraine may have some impact here. And the reality is that we are sort of burning money by supplying armaments to the Ukrainians. That will, of course, have an impact on the UK. Yes, we have sort of sanctioned Russia. Therefore, the oil and gas are not coming on the market, hence increasing the energy price. But the reality is that the Conservative Party needs to abandon its ideologically based economic policies. They really don't have much left in the fiscal armory to do. Yes, we've got the Chancellor who's going to be announcing his budget on 31st of October, an ominous day, Halloween, you know, which is the sign of sort of coming out of summer into the dark days of winter. Perhaps Britain is moving into the dark days of winter, whilst we haven't had a very bright summer either.
Well, to use your words, dark days of winter is what I think we're looking at. Lempadopic, if you agree, where there has been predictions made by, I think, the UK electric power grid that there may be three-hour outages in electricity. So let's take a little bit of a break, Lempadopic, if we can, from the economic aspects of Rishi Sunak and the challenges he faces there, and how he needs to get his party together. Based on the report that we just saw by Rob Carter, the Conservative Party's popularity is really lagging behind the Labour, and it has dropped quite dramatically. And there's, of course, talks of infighting within the party. How much of a challenge does that pose for Sunak, even though he is picking, I guess, new cabinet members, and a reshuffle is on the way from what we understand?
It's in process now. You mentioned the pending power cuts, which Rishi Sunak himself warned would happen. Well, the lights are going off on the popularity of the Conservative Party, and you could say that Liz Truss was massively instrumental in putting the Conservative Party 30 percentage points behind Labour. It's not because I think that Keir Starmer's doing a particularly good job. I think he's a rather poor opposition leader. But by default, the Conservatives are so unpopular that people go to Labour thinking, well, anyone but the Conservatives. And Boris Johnson didn't help either. What can he do is the question you asked me. What he can do is a good job of the economy. He can stop those power cuts, because if the power cuts come, everyone will remember, at least people of my age, will remember the winter of discontent, as it was called in 1978 and 1979, a line which Margaret Thatcher, Tory opposition leader, went on to be Prime Minister, used against Labour. Well, they'll get that thrown right back in their face. Internally, he also has problems, because some people still blame Rishi Sunak for the demise of Boris Johnson's premiership. And because there wasn't an election, let's remember, Rishi Sunak was not elected prime minister. He was appointed by minister by default. That means there's that discontent in the party too. Can he pull it back? Not without some luck. He needs to be lucky that there aren't power cuts, because that will really put the lights out on popularity of the Tories right up to the next election. And he needs to be lucky with party discipline, because there isn't much of that either at the moment. It remains to be seen if he has the leadership to do those things. For the sake of my own quality of life, I hope he does. But there's an awful lot of doubt. And Rishi Sunak, if he makes it to the election, well and good. If he gets deposed, there will be a general election, because the Conservative Party is almost torn apart as it is.
Okay, unfortunately, we have to get back into the economy again here, Shabbir Rizvi, based on how things are going. But an important stat that I brought up before coming on, and I'm curious as to whether the general public there in the UK even, or the wider world, actually is aware of the fact that more than one in five of the UK population, which is 22%, actually live in poverty. I mean, that's quite a stat, almost a quarter. So if we're looking at that particular stat, all indications are at this point, if the UK is going on the track that it is, that that's going to increase. There needs to be something that bridges the UK finances in order to be able to increase people's livelihoods. And that, I'm talking very generally now. so that people don't have to suffer as much, whether it's, as Lambert Opik said, the big three, like mortgages or food or other things, the social services perhaps. The big question is, where is that money going to come from? He can't tax his way into generating income. That usually doesn't work, if I'm correct to say that. How do you think he should approach it?
Well, there are possibilities of what you're saying, that yes, one in five have huge difficulties, and also we have on a daily basis 5 million people going to the food banks. So there are a whole host of issues as far as economics is concerned. But the reality is that politics impinges on economics, and economics impinges on politics, if you like. There's two sides of the same coin. And if the political situation is not stable, and the Conservative Party carries on in this way, and I was only reading today before coming on to this interview, is that there are some Conservative Party members who are in the Boris brand, if you like, are already sort of jockeying to get rid of Sunak. And it is said that perhaps he might not last until Christmas. So that's perhaps another development that's taking place, and we'll see what happens. But his really big challenge, as our other guest has pointed out, is really the economic issue. And there aren't sort of any silver bullets for him, if you like. Taxing higher, will that generate enough revenue? Or the thought of growing the economy, as the former previous prime minister kept on saying that she wants to grow the economy. How will they grow the economy? Which sectors of the economy would grow? And then, of course, the whole issue of immigration. Do immigrants, new immigrants coming in, contribute to the growth of the economy? Because of the whole sort of problems and challenges and the sort of maligning of immigrants and asylum seekers in the UK, that again is not an avenue that is open to the UK to bring in new blood, sure, from foreign countries to grow the economy.
Okay. We only have 30 seconds, Lambert Opik. £2.5 billion so far assistance to Ukraine. UK has announced that it will match it for the year 2023. That's £12 million per day. How could the UK afford that?
It's a political necessity for Rishi Sunak. If he looks like he's not going to be sponsoring Ukraine, he'll be accused of weak leadership. The rights and the wrongs of it, in military terms and political terms, don't matter, except to save his back.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to end in there. Lambert Opik there, former member of the British Parliament from London, and also from London, Shibir Rizvi, political analyst. Thank you to you both. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitapoy and the team. It's goodbye. Until the next program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.